You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in Oregon and beyond. Today, I'm joined by Nate Peterson, co-author of Pseudoscience, an amusing history of crackpot ideas and why we love them. We've spoken a lot on the show about the threats posed by pseudoarchaeology, and so today we're going to zoom out a bit and explore some of the origin stories at the heart of these problematic narratives. Nate, the last time I saw you, I think it was after hours on Halloween night in the Deschutes History Museum in Bend many years ago, and I was thinking the other day, I wish we had a microscope or a microphone on us then. That would have been super fun to hear. I remember that being a really fun night. But welcome to the show. It's great to talk to you again.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here today. And, you know, I think reflecting back on our last meeting being on Halloween, it's kind of appropriate that today we can sit down and talk about pseudoscience as well.
Yes, yes. So I want to start out by talking about the book. It's playful, it's approachable, but at the same time, you do acknowledge that there's both harmful and harmless conspiracy theories and pseudosciences out there today. And I think the world, you know, that we live in now is very different from that Halloween night in the darkened basement of the museum. And so before we don our tinfoil hats and get into the details, I wanted to start a little bit about how this book came to be and if you had to kind of navigate and shift as people think about these things a little bit differently. Conspiracy theories were all fun and games in the X-File eras, and today's socio-political climate, they can be, you know, befuddling at best and alarming at worst. So, you know, just maybe let us know a little bit about your thoughts on that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so the book came to be, it's the third book that Lydia Kang and I have co-written together. So she's a practicing family physician in Omaha, Nebraska, and she's also a writer, both of fiction and nonfiction. And we've banded together to now produce three books. The first one was Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. And then the second one was Patient Zero, A Curious History of Epidemic Diseases. And that one was kind of interestingly timed because it came out right in the heart of COVID. And then, you know, we go and write this book about pseudoscience and it comes out now. That kind of feeds into your question when we're, as a nation, as a culture, you know, having pretty big conversations about what pseudoscience means and what's harmful and what's not. And we're revisiting a lot of conspiracy theories, and they've taken on a sort of a more somber tone than they used to have. And certainly, you know, there's one of the attractions of conspiracies, one of the attractions of pseudoscience can be that sense of playfulness, that sense of fun, and that sense of sort of like building mystery and participating in a mystery that's bigger than yourself. It's interesting, you know, and like viewing the world through a lens where there's some mystery left in it. Not everything's been explained by science, but of course, it also has the possibility to be taken too far, to be taken in dangerous directions. And some of the most egregious examples of that we purposely left out of this book. As you mentioned, it's the intention here is to have a bit of a playful tone, to have a little bit of fun with some of the stuff, even though we're looking at how science has disproven the topics we discuss in the book, they're still approached with a bit of fun. So we purposely left out topics like gay conversion therapy or racial superiority theory. I mean, those are really awful ways that pseudoscience has been used to cause significant harm. And those needed to be treated in a different book with a different tone. So we left that kind of thing out of this book and instead try to focus on things like UFOs and cryptids and things that are maybe a little bit more fun to think and talk about.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting to think about, you know, how much you had to kind of balance that to find, you know, what is the book you want to write about this? There's other books that can be written about this, but this one is trying to kind of explore maybe some of the pull in a way that's less weighty. But so I wanted to think about a little bit about this dichotomy that you present in the book. So we've got harmful versus harmless. So we've got crop circles versus climate change, for example. Or when I was just skimming this again this morning, I came across the chapter of Rumpology, which was Sylvester Stallone's mom. Is that right? So there's some in here that are really out there and a pretty fun counterbalance to kind of the more depressing aspects of climate change denial or climate denial.
Well, yeah, I mean, Rumpology is a great counterpoint to that, right? Like that's in the body divination chapter. So, you know, like throughout all of time, right, there's been various ways that we've attempted to interpret the future. And a very creative way to go about doing that was developed by no less than Sylvester Stallone's mother, who decided that the key to your future lay in your behind, you know, and literally, I mean, your butt. That sounds like I'm making it a joke, and I wish I was, but it was really something that people were happy to pay money for, to have their butts examined and their fortunes told by virtue of the sort of the formation of the butt or the cleft or the curvature of it, which, you know, is just kind of wild to think about. But it also shows you how desperate we all are sometimes to have some glimpse into the mystery of the future.
And maybe another plug to buy the book, because you have the chart of butts in there that you could use to maybe self-diagnose, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And you're welcome to do so.
So that gets into a little bit about how you structured the book. You divided it up into themes. You've got pure nonsense, the cryptozoology and UFO section, the willful thinking section, and grifters, nihilism, and denialism. And so this really does allow you to kind of like collect a large variety of topics in history under one roof, so to speak. So how did you come up with those different themes?
Yeah, so the way Lydia and I typically work when we're approaching a book like this is we'll share a Google document and we'll just throw a whole bunch of potential topics in there. And then each of us kind of dives into them a little bit and tries to see which ones maybe have some traction, which ones we might be able to unite around tone. And we end up dividing the chapters up and sort of one of us writes half, the other writes the other half. And then we kind of go in and start editing each other's chapters and create this unified whole. These topics were ones that we felt like by and large could be dealt with a playful tone, you know, with a couple of exceptions. Like sometimes the book gets a little bit serious, climate change denial being probably the most serious chapter in the book, because that is obviously a major current concern that's influencing current policy. But a lot of the things in here are either, you know, topics that have been disproven long in the past, like pseudoscientific theories that had their day in the sun a long time ago. You know, I'm thinking here of like auguries, like the ancient Roman practice of predicting the future through the behavior of chickens. You know, like that one has long since, you know, been pushed away by the waves of time. But other ones are still with us today. And those, like some, the tone sometimes shifts in accordance with that because they just needed to be treated a little bit more seriously. And although some of the ones that are with us today also are still kind of fun to talk and think about, right? Like astrology or ufology or cryptids in particular, right? Thinking about how every single state in the country has its own version of a Bigfoot hiding somewhere out there.
You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. You can find us online at jeffexchange.org. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. And today we are talking about how every state has its own version of Bigfoot out there and much more, as ways people have creatively applied science to justify outlandish theories. So I wonder, when you were researching this, where did you go to get your content? I was wondering specifically, and I kind of have to ask this as an archaeologist, did you get into some archaeological research as part of, you know, maybe not debunking Bigfoot or UFOs, but some of the other topics that you are looking at?
Well, usually the research process starts like it does sort of for anyone, right? With a Google search, and then it gets increasingly deep from there. And usually for me, I end up purchasing books and kind of building a book collection over time related to the topics that I'm writing about. Because each book that you read, that's a secondary source. Maybe there's references to some primary sources. You start building that up as well. And eventually you can get pretty deep into it. And sort of that, it's a combination of both, you know, looking at these topics from the perspective of the believers in them, and then also balancing that with like peer-reviewed scientific articles coming from the other direction, demonstrating the science as to why some of these things don't work. But as to, you know, archaeology itself, one of the chapters I wrote that I think ties most heavily into archaeology is the one on ley lines. Uh-huh. And that's this idea particularly popular in Britain. That's where it originated, but it's been applied across the world, that ancient monuments are able to be aligned via straight pathways if you're looking at them on a map. And it creates this sort of grid work of potentially sacred energy connecting these ancient monuments and ancient sites. And perhaps those have some kind of ancient meaning as well. And, you know, one of the common conclusions drawn from that is that it was like a landing grid network for UFOs.
Oh, yeah.
Or that ancient like geomancers, sort of like wizards or druid figures in ancient British history, tapped into some kind of energy source that they were able to have conducted along these ley lines between these sites of significance and importance. And, you know, that one's, in my opinion, relatively harmless, perhaps not from the perspective of an archaeologist. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that as well. But it's a little bit fun to play around with. And as someone who enjoys a good countryside quest, I can't really blame somebody for wanting to go out and explore the countryside to look for ways to connect, you know, ancient sites.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in thinking about some of the pseudo-archaeology conversations I've had too, it's like anything that can be wrapped up too neatly, you know, with people cherry pick data, or like there's always this pull to like have this neat and tidy story, like, oh, all these sites connect on these lines. You know, I think that that's always suspect when that happens. But it kind of gets me to my next question, which is like the intention versus just like what kind of things are believed either passively or as a way to kind of negotiate some of the things in the world around us versus the beliefs that are intentionally, you know, pushed upon others as a way to exploit them. Like when you get into the con men chapter in there. So that's more like somebody I would assume probably most of the time knows that they're pushing false narratives, but they're monetizing it or commodifying those things.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's certainly bad actors. You know, there's a section in the book that's entitled Grifters, Nihilism, and Denialism. And a lot of those bad actors are discussed in there. Though they also appear in other sections too. One other area is gasoline pills. You know, this idea that this is kind of a common con man thing to do, like this advertisement that this pill you have can essentially turn water into a combustible fuel for a car engine. And, you know, which never actually works, but it allows for somebody to make a little bit of money through some smoke and mirrors, basically. It's a little bit of trickery in the meantime. And, you know, that it's an interesting thing because these problems are really big problems at scale. And I don't mean to undermine the fact that, you know, the individual that pays a guy in a, you know, suburban Iowa, like a few bucks at some point in time to try this water pill, essentially to turn water into gasoline. Like, sure, that kind of sucks. Like they lost some money in that, like, you know, but it's also didn't do a huge amount of damage at the same time versus like climate change denial being the big one, right? Where there's like a major push for that narrative because there's a lot of money to be made from denying that climate change is happening. There's a lot of agendas that can be enacted if we pretend that's not a real thing. Yeah. So, you know, that's a delicate balance. And sometimes I even have a little bit more, you know, you can kind of smile and nod a little bit at a grifter, especially if they're making an audacious claim, you know, like a claim that's so outrageous that you're like, well, how, okay. But like Rumpology being a good one, like really, like you believe that, you know? Like, okay, you know, like I don't feel horribly bad for you that you spent $50 to have your butt examined, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, that's obviously though a hugely different thing than enacting some kind of major political or even cultural agenda based on pseudoscience where there's real harm that can be done both to ourselves and to our, you know, the future inhabitants of the planet.
You cover dowsing in your book, and I have to say I live in a rural area and there's a lot of self-proclaimed water witches, and my well is supposedly found by one. And I've seen it used on construction sites where water lines have been hard to find. And then somebody comes out with the dowsing rods and they find it. I've never been able to do it, but I wanted to talk more about that as like an example of how people's personal experiences may, you know, interface with topics in the book and how that might lead to like, you know, real conviction in these theories or real resistance to seeing or hearing the evidence against them. And you know, that probably looks different in a lot of these different examples, you know, talking about Rumpology to climate change. But, you know, did you come across some of that in your research, the ways that, you know, people really just double down on these things that, you know, objectively seem ridiculous?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a trademark of pseudoscience is that believers in it value anecdotal evidence over data. You know, and personal stories and testimonials are emotionally powerful things, and they're often pretty persuasive and usually more persuasive than boring, cold, hard statistical evidence, right? And, you know, the other thing to kind of consider too, and dowsing is a good example of that, or even just UFOs in general, you know, people have had intense personal experiences in that no amount of science would ever convince them otherwise of, right? And so like dowsing, currently, there's no scientific basis for that, but can I at the same time deny that there's been real world benefits from that happening? Of course there have been, right? And similarly, like, while we still don't have hard scientific evidence of the existence of alien civilizations, is that something that's always going to be the case? You know, like my personal belief is probably not. Like the molecules that create intelligent life are everywhere in the universe. The universe is vast. You know, I'm kind of paraphrasing Carl Sagan here, but, you know, at the moment there's not scientific evidence to say conclusively that exists, but that doesn't mean there always won't be either, right? And so we tried to keep that in mind as well as we were writing this, is that, you know, in some cases the science isn't over yet, it's still being written. That's that that doesn't devalue the science either. You know, that's good science. Science needs to keep on questioning itself and drawing new conclusions from new hypotheses and continue this quest for information and for inquiry. And I think that's healthy. And sometimes we still don't know everything about something, but we can say at this stage, here's what we do know, and this does not appear to be scientifically valid.
Yeah, and I have so many questions on that, but first we're going to take a quick break and we will be back with more Underground History. And we're back. You're listening to Underground History. I'm Chelsea Rose, and we are talking pseudoscience. So, yeah, that really, what you were just talking about really stresses the science part of this. And I was thinking about, you know, with dowsing, you know, maybe it works sometimes, but what are they, the saying is like a clock is right twice a day, no matter what, or, you know, I can't right. remember what that saying is, but, you know, so the real danger is when people cherry pick or they really, like you said, rely on anecdotal evidence instead of like the scientific method or things that can be proven, you know, objectively over and over. And that's, you know, that's where a lot of this kind of falls. And so some of these things in your book, I mean, I think conspiracy theory, you know, where did you draw the line of what even fell into like the science category at all, even the pseudoscience category? Because some of these things are pretty fantastical and maybe wouldn't even be thought about in that way.
Right. Yeah, we did try to, you know, unite the book around topics that science has weighed in on, right, and mm-hmm. and offers some kind of compelling conclusion. You know, and sometimes that goes in the face of just people's empirical observation. You know, that's a big challenge, I think, for all of us. And I'm, you know, 100% would include myself in this too. I think all of us have had pseudoscientific beliefs we've clung to for various reasons at different times in our lives, right? You know, one that kind of makes me laugh is the first chapter that starts this book off, which is about the flat Earth theory. Mm-hmm. You know, and like the thing is, right, like if you go outside right now, or if you just look out your window, the world looks kind of flat, you know, like that's a hard one to argue with just based on what you're personally observing.
Yeah.
But the science is just so overwhelming that that's not the case. I mean, just in every possible way, science has taken that one down. Right. So, you know, I think one thing that happens a bit with people that believe in pseudoscience is that there's just absolutely no amount of convincing them otherwise, unless they personally can have the experience of like using flat Earth as an example, personally having the experience of hopping in a rocket ship, flying above the Earth's atmosphere and looking back down and saying, okay, yes, the photos that NASA released were accurate. You know, yeah. this is a round planet that we live on. I think people oftentimes it's hard to get past what you personally see, especially if you're just kind of disinclined to trust institutions in general, right?
Yeah. Well, it's, yeah. And speaking of seeing, I want to jump a little bit to aliens and ghosts, but first, so let's start with aliens. So I think many in my generation, like me, were traumatized. There's a certain episode of Unsolved Mysteries where they talk about like losing time and being like frozen in your sleep. And I still, I'm totally freaked out by aliens about that, especially there was another one about Fire in the Sky. I think that was a book that came out about loggers in the Pacific Northwest being abducted. But so there's a lot of stuff that has like a veneer, like that movie especially really presents itself as nonfiction. But when I was at the University of Oregon, I remember reading an article about how UFOs replaced fairy stories during, you know, the Industrial Revolution. And they were a way, instead of people having to kind of like grapple with the realities of the unknown surrounding nature, there are people trying to work out their fears and anxieties about, you know, technology. And some of our, you know, so that seems really interesting to me and something worth kind of pulling a thread on. But also, I think it's interesting that our modern aesthetics of this alien fascination really come out of the post-war, you know, mid-20th century. So I was just curious if you could speak a little bit to that, like what happened in the 40s, late 40s, that made everybody just really get, you know, drawn to this.
Well, I think just start with the sort of the first half of that question. I think you've touched on an interesting element here too. I hadn't heard that before about the fairies UFO contrast, but I think the uniting thread there, which is interesting to me, is that it's people trying to make sense of the world around them when it seems kind of strange and overwhelming, you know. And I think that's a common human experience, like part of like what you might call the human condition, right? Going back throughout all of history, you know, and how we interpret the phenomena we see around us is heavily influenced by the culture that we grew up in and whatever cognitive biases we have or that we've developed. And I think it's interesting to think back to a time when the world was interpreted more through sort of through magic, frankly, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the world that fairies can come out of. And then it shifts to a world that's interpreted largely through science. And that's a world where UFOs come out of. But to tie that into the second half of your question, I think, of course, what you see happening in the 40s, 50s and onward is this increased aviation, right? Like aviation becomes a commercially available thing for everybody eventually. And there's a lot more activity in the sky, both in terms of activity you can participate in and look out the window of your airplane and see something strange in the sky, but also in the sense of people on the ground looking up in the sky and starting to see things there that they didn't used to see before. And then, of course, like the technology of aviation has just continued to unfold and increase in significant proportions over time, especially over the last 50, 60 years. And so now you add to that drones and experimental weapons and experimental satellites and that kind of thing. And the night sky, which used to be pretty empty like 100 years ago, is now just full of things, right?
Yeah.
And so I think just these rapid and sudden advancements in technology, which create uncertainty for people, also lead to, these sometimes creative ways to solve that problem by coming up with answers to the question of what am I seeing out there that aren't always the right answer. But it's understandable, the sort of, but the world is complex and it's difficult to interpret at times. And it's understandable to reach conclusions that aren't always backed up by science. But it's important to also then pause and take the time to revisit the assumptions or conclusions you've made, to recognize that none of us are always right anyway, right? And to review what else is out there, like to review other points of view.
Yeah, and the more stuff in the sky, the more unidentified flying objects are going to be out there. So you're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and today we are talking about a new book on crackpot ideas and why we love them. So now let's talk ghosts. So I'm a scientist, but I still have a healthy distrust of creepy dolls and things that could be haunted. But I really think the history of spiritualism and the paranormal is really fascinating because there's a lot of different ways that people are drawn to this great beyond. Some folks want to commune with loved ones or gain wisdom from, beyond the veil, but others are looking for jump scares and all of these things. This whole spectrum of interest has been commodified and monetized. So I wondered if you could speak a little bit about that. So, spiritualism and ghosts isn't always what people think about.
Right. Ghost hunting's a big business now.
Yeah.
I currently live in Savannah, Georgia, which I think is maybe the number one ghost hunting destination
in the world. I've been on a ghost hunt or ghost tour there in the back of a hearse.
Okay. Yes. You're right. There's every night I see the hearse ghost tours traveling around the historic squares here. So, ghosts are now big business. And, I think on the one hand, it's this interest in just like, like horror movies are also really popular, right? Like there's an interest in that jump scare element of like the seeing that happen. If you're watching a ghost hunting show, like seeing somebody like encounter some strange phenomena and get scared. And, there's like a thrill through that, that you experience, even if you're not physically there. But ghosts are also, I think the reason we come back to that belief over and over again is because, it's so hard to contemplate death as this final experience. Like the finality of death is a difficult one for all of us to come to terms with. And so we look for ways to maybe act like that's not always going to be the case, right? And a belief in ghosts allows us to do that. Going back to your comment on spiritualism, like that rose pretty strongly out of the ashes of the Civil War, the American Civil War, where you had, just an unspeakable number of people that were killed, relative to the population size of that time, and just a nation going through just an exponential amount of grief and looking for answers and looking for ways to reconnect with people that died. And I don't think it's not an accident that spiritualism flourishes in the post-Civil War era, mm-hmm. and then continues with us today. And, again, you know, when you're getting into topics around the afterlife or the possibility of the continuation of existence in some form, it's one of those things that's really can be really deeply felt and personal for people, and they might feel really strongly about it. And of course, it even ties into deep convictions around religion and spirituality as well. So, you know, it's in the book we try to handle that gently and just offer what current science has to say on the matter, which is it's currently quite conclusive, but again, science changes over time,
Yeah, and the way
right? You
that
know.
people have brought science into that has also changed over time. Like the early spiritualists, they would try to like have the ectoplasm, like, and they had different ways that they tried to add this veneer of science. And now people have like the, what is it, EMF, yeah, electromagnetic frequency readers, and like all these things that seem very scientific and tech. You know, there's always that draw to legitimize these things with technology.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, there's always and that's kind of a budding industry as well. You know, there's always ways to make money from pseudoscience and yeah, certainly the interest in ghost hunting and exploring, you know, an abandoned house late at night with an EMF device. You know, like there's people that will happily make you a device that may or may not produce the result it's supposed to. But you know, at the same time, it's kind of like hunting for cryptids. You know, it's like as long as no one's getting hurt, you know, it's okay, maybe, right? You know, sure, you want to maybe spend your weekend out in the woods of Washington State looking for Bigfoot, or maybe you want to spend your weekend on a Hearst ghost tour in Savannah or exploring in an abandoned place nearby with a haunted reputation. You know, like those are both elements of thrill seeking, you know, that we as humans we enjoy that experience anyway, right? And you know, as long as you're being safe and no one's getting harmed, it's and you know, you're maybe checking your own belief system a little bit every now and then. You know, I think it's relatively harmless.
Yeah, and that I think that's a great kind of note to wrap up on is like, what's your advice for people when they see these kind of conspiracy theories or pseudoscience out there and they're drawn to it because it can be fun, but what do you think should be people's North Star for trying to figure out if something is harmless or if it if there is, you know, something in there that could cause harm? You know, what red flag should people look for besides getting your
That's a
book is the first thing they should do.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I didn't even think of that one. So yeah, so of course the main thing to do is to go and buy pseudoscience at your local bookstore. But once you've done that, you know, I wish there was an easy answer to that. And the fact that there isn't is also the reason that pseudoscience has an opportunity to flourish, you know, and all of us are guilty of creating our own little echo chambers. It's really easy to do right now with our social media accounts, with our the ways we can kind of guide our own online searches. But you know, I think it's usually best to try to approach pseudoscience with some patience. You know, the scientific method itself takes a while to play out, and that's a good thing. You know, we should all like celebrate that because that's how we're able to come up with solutions to problems, basically, right? And but it takes time for the scientific method to enact itself, to work itself through. And so while that's happening, it's important, I think, to kind of just do a little bit of a check on yourself and think to yourself, am I, you know, is my interest in this just kind of fun and harmless, or am I being influenced by something like a mistrust I might have of institutions or a cognitive bias that I might have? Am I valuing anecdotal evidence over data? Am I, or really, am I just interested in this because it's fun, you know, in which case, okay, you know, like that's okay too. But I think we all just need to remember that the scientific method works for a reason, you know, and it's led to these great, significant, and extraordinary advances in human civilization. But the reason it's been able to do that is because we've given it the time it needs for that process to play out, for that process to happen. So I think, you know, it's okay to be uncertain. It's okay to not know the answer. It's okay to wait for the evidence to come in. And I think that's the takeaway I'd offer for people encountering pseudoscience today.
And it's okay to be like Mulder and want to believe, right?
That's also okay too, most of the
Most of the time, not always. Yes. Good. Well,
right.
thank you so much, Nate. That was awesome. This wraps up this round of Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Our show producers are Natalie Golay and Charlie Zimmerman. You can find this episode and more wherever you get your podcast. You can find Nate's book, Pseudoscience: Amusing History of Crackpot Ideas and Why We Love Them, at your local independent bookstore.